This is Chapter 11 of Tom Sawyer Abroad. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Tom Sawyer Abroad by Mark Twain. Chapter 11. The Sandstorm.
We went a-fooling along for a day or two, and then just as the full moon was touching the ground on the other side of the desert, we see a string of little black figures moving across its big silver face. You could see them as plain as if they was painted on the moon with ink. It was another caravan. We cooled down our speed and tagged along after it, just to have company, though it weren't going our way. It was a rattler, that caravan, and a most bully sight to look at next morning when the sun come a-streaming across the desert and flung the long shadders of the camels on the gold sand like a thousand granddaddy longlegses marching in procession. We never went very near it, because we knowed better now than to act like that and scare people's camels and break up their caravans. It was the gayest outfit you ever see, for rich clothes and knobby style. Some of the chiefs rode on dromedaries, the first we ever see, and very tall, and they go plunging along like they was on stilts, and they rock the man that is on them pretty violent and churn up his dinner considerable, I bet you. But they make noble good time, and a camel ain't nowheres with them for speed. The caravan camped during the middle part of the day, and then started again about the middle of the afternoon. Before long the sun begun to look very curious. First it kind of turned to brass, then to copper, and after that it begun to look like a blood-red ball, and the air got hot and close, and pretty soon all the sky in the west darkened up and looked thick and foggy, but fiery and dreadful, like it looks through a piece of red glass, you know. We looked down and see a big confusion going on in the caravan, and a-rushing every which way like they was scared, and then they all flopped down flat in the sand and laid there perfectly still. Pretty soon we see something coming that stood up like an amazing wide wall and reached from the desert up into the sky and hid the sun, and it was coming like the nation, too. Then a little faint breeze struck us, and then it come harder, and grains of sand begun to sift against our faces and sting like fire, and Tom sung out, "It's a sandstorm! Turn your backs to it!" We done it, and in another minute it was blowing a gale, and the sand beat against us by the shovelful, and the air was so thick with it we couldn't see a thing. In 5 minutes the boat was level full, and we was setting on the lockers buried up to the chin in sand, and only our heads out, and could hardly breathe. Then the storm thinned, and we see that monstrous wall go a-sailing off across the desert, awful to look at, I tell you. We dug ourselves out and looked down, and where the caravan was before, there wasn't anything but just the sand ocean now, and all still and quiet. All them people and camels was smothered and dead and buried under 10 foot of sand, we reckoned, and Tom allowed it might be years before the wind uncovered them, and all that time their friends wouldn't ever know what become of that caravan. Tom said, "Now we know what it was that happened to the people we got the swords and pistols from." Yes, sir, that was just it. It was as plain as day now. They got buried in a sandstorm, and the wild animals couldn't get at them, and the wind never uncovered them again until they was dried to leather and weren't fit to eat. It seemed to me we had felt as sorry for them poor people as a person could for anybody, and as mournful, too, but we was mistaken. This last caravan's death went harder with us, a good deal harder. You see, the others was total strangers, and we never got to feeling acquainted with them at all, except maybe a little with the man that was watching the girl, but it was different with this last caravan. We was hovering around them a whole night and most the whole day, and had got to feeling real friendly with them and acquainted. I have found out that there ain't no sure way to find out whether you like people or hate them than to travel with them. Just so with these. We kind of liked them from the start, and traveling with them put on the finisher. The longer we traveled with them, and the more we got used to their ways, the better and better we liked them, and the gladder and gladder we was that we run across them. We had come to know some of them so well that we called them by name when we was talking about them, and soon got so familiar and sociable that we even dropped the Miss and Mister and just used their plain names without any handle, and it did not seem unpolite, but just the right thing. Of course, it wasn't their own names, but names we give them. There was Mr. Alexander Robinson and Miss Adeline Robinson, and Colonel Jacob McDougal, and Miss Harriet McDougal, and Judge Jeremiah Butler, and young Bushrod Butler, and these was big chiefs mostly, that wore splendid great turbans and scimitars, and dressed like the Grand Mogul, and their families. But as soon as we come to know them good, and like them very much, it weren't Mister, nor Judge, nor nothing any more, but only Alec, and Addie, and Jake, and Hattie, and Jerry, and Buck, and so on. And you know, the more you join in with people and their joys and their sorrows, the more near and dear they come to be to you. Now we weren't cold and indifferent the way most travelers is. We was right down friendly and sociable, and took a chance in everything that was going. And the caravan could depend on us to be on hand every time. It didn't make no difference what it was. When they camped, we camped right over them, 10 or 1,200 feet up in the air. When they ate a meal, we ate ourn, and it made it ever so much homeliker to have their company. When they had a wedding that night, and Buck and Addie got married, we got ourselves up in the very starchiest of the professor's duds for the blowout, and when they danced, we jined in and shook a foot up there. But it is sorrow and trouble that brings you the nearest, and it was a funeral that done it with us. It was next morning, just in the still dawn. We didn't know the diseased, and he weren't in our set, but that never made no difference. He belonged to the caravan, and that was enough. And there weren't no more sincere tears shed over him than the ones we dripped on him from up there, 1,100 foot on high. Yes, parting with this caravan was much more bitterer than it was to part with them others, which was comparative strangers, and been dead so long anyway. We had knowed these in their lives, and was fond of them, too, and now to have death snatched them from right before our faces whilst we was looking, and leave us so lonesome and friendless in the middle of that big desert, it did hurt so, and we wished we mightn't ever make any more friends on that voyage if we was going to lose them again like that. We couldn't keep from talking about them, and they was all the time coming up in our memory, and looking just the way they looked when we was all alive and happy together. We could see the line marching, and the shiny spearheads a-winking in the sun. We could see the dromedaries lumbering along. We could see the wedding and the funeral. And more oftener than anything else, we could see them praying, because they don't allow nothing to prevent that. Whenever the call come, several times a day, they would stop right there, and stand up and face to the east, and lift back their heads, and spread out their arms, and begin, and 4 or 5 times they would go down on their knees, and then fall forward and touch their forehead to the ground. Well, it weren't good to go on talking about them, lovely as they was in their life, and dear to us in their life and death both, because it didn't do no good, and made us too downhearted. Jim allowed he was going to live as good a life as he could, so he could see them again in a better world. And Tom kept still and didn't tell him they was only Mohammedans. It weren't no use to disappoint him. He was feeling bad enough just as it was. When we woke up next morning, we was feeling a little cheerfuller, and had had a most powerful good sleep, because sand is the comfortablest bed there is, and I don't see why people that can afford it don't have it more. And it's terrible good ballast, too. I never see a balloon so steady before. Tom allowed we had 20 tons of it, and wondered what we better do with it. It was good sand, and it didn't seem good sense to throw it away. Jim says, "Marse Tom, can't we tote it back home and sell it? How long it'll take?"
"Depends on the way we go."
"Well, sir, she's worth $0.25 a load at home, and I reckon we's got as many as 20 loads, ain't we? How much would that be?"
$5.
"By jings, Marse Tom, let's shove for home right on the spot. It's more than $1.50 piece, ain't it?"
"Yes."
"Well, if Dad ain't making money the easiest ever I struck. She just reined in. Never cost us a lick of work. Let's mosey right along, Marse Tom."
But Tom was thinking and ciphering away so busy and excited he never heard him. Pretty soon he says, $5, sure. Look here, this sand's worth—why, it's worth no end of money."
"How's that, Marse Tom? Go on, honey, go on."
"Well, the minute people knows it's genuine sand from the genuine desert of Sahara, they'll just be in a perfect state of mind to get hold of some of it to keep on the whatnot in a vial with a label on it for curiosity. All we got to do is to put it up in vials and float around all over the United States and peddle them out at 10 cents apiece. We've got all of $10,000 worth of sand in this boat. Me and Jim went all to pieces with joy and begun to shout, "Whoop jamboreehoo!" And Tom says, "And we can keep on coming back and fetching sand and coming back and fetching more sand, and just keep it a-going till we've carted this whole desert over there and sold it out. And there ain't ever going to be any opposition either, because we'll take out a patent." "My goodness," I says, "we'll be as rich as creosote, won't we, Tom?"
"Yes, Croesus, you mean. Why, that dervish was hunting in that little hill for the treasures of the earth and didn't know he was walking over the real ones for 1,000 miles. He was blinder than he made the driver."
"Mars Tom, how much is we going to be worth?"
"Well, I don't know yet. It's got to be ciphered, and it ain't the easiest job to do, either, because it's over 4 million square miles of sand at 10 cents a vial."
Jim was awful excited, but this faded it out considerable, and he shook his head and says,
"Mars Tom, we can't afford all them vials. A king couldn't. We better not try to take the whole desert, Mars Tom. The vial's gwine to bust us, sho'."
Tom's excitement died out, too, now, and I reckoned it was on account of the vials, but it wasn't. He set there thinking and got bluer and bluer, and at last he says,
"Boys, it won't work. We got to give it up."
"Why, Tom?"
"On account of the duties." I couldn't make nothing out of that, neither could Jim. I says,
"What is our duty, Tom? Because if we can't get around it, why can't we just do it? People often has to."
But he says, "Oh, it ain't that kind of duty. The kind I mean is a tax. Whenever you strike a frontier, that's the border of a country, you know, you find a custom house there, and the government officers comes and rummages amongst your things and charges a big tax, which they call a duty, because it's their duty to bust you if they can, and if you don't pay the duty, they'll hog your sand. They call it confiscating, but that don't deceive nobody. It's just hogging, and that's all it is. Now, if we try to carry this sand home the way we're pointed now, we got to climb fences till we get tired, just frontier after frontier, Egypt, Arabia, Hindustan, and so on, and they'll all whack on a duty, and so you see, easy enough, we can't go that road."
"Why, Tom," I says, "we can sail right over their old frontiers. How are they going to stop us?"
He looked sorrowful at me and says, very grave, "Huck Finn, do you think that would be honest?" I hate them kind of interruptions. I never said nothing, and he went on, "Well, we're shut off the other way, too. If we go back the way we've come, there's the New York Custom House, and that is worse than all of them others put together on account of the kind of cargo we've got."
"Why?"
"Well, they can't raise Sahara sand in America, of course, and when they can't raise a thing there, the duty is 1,400,000% on it if you try to fetch it in from where they do raise it."
"There ain't no sense in that, Tom Sawyer."
"Who said there was? What do you talk to me like that for, Huck Finn? You wait till I say a thing's got sense in it before you go to accusing me of saying it."
"All right. Consider me crying about it. And sorry. Go on."
Jim says,
"Mars Tom, do they jam dat duty onto everything we can't raise in America, and don't make no stinction twixt anything?"
"Yes, that's what they do."
"Mars Tom, ain't the blessing of the Lord the most valuable thing dey is?"
"Yes, it is."
"Don't the preacher stand up in the pulpit and call it down on the people?"
"Yes."
"Where do it come from?"
"From heaven."
"Yes, sir. You's just right. Deed you is, honey. It come from heaven, and dat's a foreign country. Now then, do they put a tax on dat blessing?"
"No, they don't."
"Course they don't. And so it stand to reason dat you's mistaken, Mars Tom. Dey wouldn't put the tax on poor truck like sand dat everybody ain't bleeged to have, and leave it off on the best thing dey is, which nobody can't get along without."
Tom Sawyer was stumped. He see Jim had got him where he couldn't budge. He tried to wiggle out by saying they had forgot to put on that tax, but they'd be sure to remember about it next session of Congress, and then they'd put it on, but that was a poor lame come-off, and he knowed it. He said there weren't nothing foreign that weren't taxed but just that one, and so they couldn't be consistent without taxing it, and to be consistent was the first law of politics. So he stuck to it that they'd left it out unintentional, and we'd be certain to do their best to fix it before they got caught and laughed at. But I didn't feel no more interest in such things, as long as we couldn't get our sand through, and it made me low-spirited, and Jim the same.
Tom, he tried to cheer us up by saying he would think up another speculation for us that would be just as good as this one and better.
But it didn't do no good. We didn't believe there was any as big as this. It was mighty hard. Such a little while ago we was so rich and could have bought a country and started a kingdom and been celebrated and happy, and now we was so poor and ornery again and had our sand left on our hands. The sand was looking so lovely before, just like gold and diamonds, and the feel of it was so soft and so silky and nice, but now I couldn't bear the sight of it. It made me sick to look at it, and I knowed I wouldn't ever feel comfortable again till we got shut of it and didn't have it there no more to remind us of what we had been and what we had got degraded down to. The others was feeling the same way about it that I was. I knowed it because they cheered up so the minute I says, "Let's throw this truck overboard."
Well, it was going to be work, you know, and pretty solid work, too. So Tom, he divided it up according to fairness and strength. He said me and him would clear out a fifth apiece of the sand, and Jim three-fifths. Jim, he didn't quite like that arrangement. He says,
"Course, I's the strongest, and I's willing to do a share accordin'. But by jings, you's kind of piling it on to old Jim, Mars Tom, ain't you?"
"Well, I didn't think so, Jim. But you try your hand at fixing it, and let's see." So Jim, he reckoned it wouldn't be no more than fair if me and Tom done a tenth apiece. Tom, he turned his back to get room and be private, and then he smole a smile that spread around and covered the whole Sahara to the westward, back to the Atlantic edge of it where we come from. Then he turned round again and said it was a good enough arrangement, and we was satisfied if Jim was. Jim said he was. So then Tom measured off our two-tenths in the bow and left the rest for Jim, and it surprised Jim a good deal to see how much difference there was and what a raging lot of sand his share come to, and said he was powerful glad now that he had spoke up in time and got the first arrangement altered, for he said that even the way it was now, there was more sand than enjoyment in his end of the contract, he believed. Then we laid into it. It was mighty hot work and tough. So hot we had to move up into cooler weather, or we couldn't have stood it. Me and Tom took turnabout, and one worked while t'other rested, but there weren't nobody to spell poor old Jim, and he made all that part of Africa damp, he sweated so. We couldn't work good, we was so full of laugh, and Jim, he kept frettin' and wanting to know what tickled us so, and we had to keep making up things to account for it, and they was pretty poor inventions, but they done well enough. Jim didn't see through them. At last, when we got done, we was most dead, but not with work, but with laughing. By and by, Jim was most dead, too, but it was with work. Then we took turns and spelled him, and he was as thankful as he could be, and would sit on the gunwale and swab the sweat and heave and pant and say how good we was to a poor old nigger, and he wouldn't ever forget us. He was always the gratefulest nigger I ever see for any little thing you done for him. He was only nigger outside. Inside, he was as white as you be. End of chapter 11.
This is chapter 12 of Tom Sawyer Abroad. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Tom Sawyer Abroad, chapter 12, Jim Standing Siege.
The next few meals was pretty sandy, but that don't make no difference when you're hungry. When you ain't, it ain't no satisfaction to eat, anyway, and so a little grit in the meat ain't no particular drawback, as far as I can see. Then we struck the east end of the desert at last, sailing on a northeast course. Away off on the edge of the sand, in a soft pinky light, we see three little sharp roofs like tents, and Tom says, "It's the pyramids of Egypt." It made my heart fairly jump. You see, I had seen a many and a many a picture of them, and heard tell about them 100 times, and yet to come on them all of a sudden that way and find they was real, instead of imaginations, most knocked the breath out of me with surprise. It's a curious thing that the more you hear about a grand and big and bully thing or person, the more it kind of dreamies out, as you may say, and gets to be a big, dim, wavery figure, made out of moonshine and nothing solid to it. It's just so with George Washington, and the same with them pyramids. And moreover, besides, the thing they always said about them seemed to me to be stretchers. There was a feller come to the Sunday school once and had a picture of them, and made a speech, and said the biggest pyramid covered 13 acres and was most 500 foot high, just a steep mountain, all built out of hunks of stone as big as a bureau, and laid up in perfectly regular layers like stair steps. 13 acres, you see, for just one building. It's a farm. If it hadn't been in Sunday school, I would have judged it was a lie. And outside, I was certain of it. And he said there was a hole in the pyramid, and you could go in there with candles, and go ever so far up a long, slanting tunnel, and come to a large room in the stomach of that stone mountain, and there you would find a big stone chest with a king in it, 4,000 years old. I said to myself then, if that ain't a lie, I will eat that king if they will fetch him, for even Methusalem weren't that old, and nobody claims it. As we come a little nearer, we see the yaller sand come to an end in a long, straight edge like a blanket, and onto it was joined, edge to edge, a wide country of bright green, with a snaky stripe crooking through it, and Tom said, it was the Nile. It made my heart jump again, for the Nile was another thing that wasn't real to me. Now, I can tell you one thing, which is dead certain. If you will fool along over 3,000 miles of yaller sand, all glimmering with heat so that it makes your eyes water to look at it, and you've been a considerable part of a week doing it, the green country will look so like home and heaven to you that it will make your eyes water again. It was just so with me, and the same with Jim. And when Jim got so he could believe it was the land of Egypt he was looking at, he wouldn't enter it standing up, but got down on his knees and took off his hat, because he said it wasn't fitting for a humble poor nigger to come any other way where such men had been as Moses and Joseph and Pharaoh and the other prophets. He was a Presbyterian, and had a most deep respect for Moses, which was a Presbyterian too, he said. He was all stirred up, and says, "It's the land of Egypt, the land of Egypt, and I's 'lowed to look at it with my own eyes, and I's the river that was turned to blood, and I's looking at the very same ground where the plagues was, and the lice, and the frogs, and the locusts, and the hail, and where they marked the doorposts, and the angel of the Lord come by in the darkness of the night, and slew the firstborn in all the land of Egypt. Old Jim ain't worthy to see this day." And then he just broke down and cried, he was so thankful. So between him and Tom, there was talk enough, Jim being excited because the land was so full of history. Joseph and his brethren, Moses and the bulrushes, Jacob coming down into Egypt to buy corn, the silver cup and the sack, and all them interesting things. And Tom just as excited, too, because the land was so full of history that was in his line, about New Redden and Bedredden and such like monstrous giants that made Jim's wool rise, and a raft of other Arabian Nights folks, which the half of them never done the things they let on they done, I don't believe. Then we struck a disappointment, for one of them early morning fog started up, and it weren't no use to sail over the top of it, because we would go by Egypt, sure, so we judged it was best to set her by compass straight for the place where the pyramids was getting blurred and blotted out, and then drop low and skin along pretty close to the ground and keep a sharp lookout. Tom took the helm, I stood by to let go the anchor, and Jim, he straddled the bow to dig through the fog with his eyes and watch out for danger ahead. We went along a steady gait, but not very fast, and the fog got solider and solider, so solid that Jim looked dim and ragged and smoky through it. It was awful still, and we talked low and was anxious. Now and then Jim would say, "Heist her a pint, Marse Tom, heist her," and up she would skip a foot or two, and we would slide right over a flat-roofed mud cabin with people that had been asleep on it, just beginning to turn out and gap and stretch. And once, when a feller was clear up on his hind legs so he could gap and stretch better, we took him a blip in the back and knocked him off. By and by, after about an hour, and everything dead still, and we a-straining our ears for sounds and holding our breath, the fog thinned a little, very sudden, and Jim sung out in an awful scare,
"Oh, for the land's sake, set her back, Marse Tom! Here's the biggest giant out in the Arabian Nights a-comin' for us!"
And he went over backwards in the boat. Tom slammed on the back action, and as we slowed to a standstill, a man's face as big as our house at home looked in over the gunwale, same as a house looks out of its windows, and I lay down and died. I must have been clear dead and gone for as much as a minute or more. Then I come to, and Tom had hitched a boat-hook onto the lower lip of the giant and was holding the balloon steady with it whilst he canted his head back and got a good long look up at that awful face. Jim was on his knees with his hands clasped, gazing up at the thing in a begging way and working his lips, but not getting anything out. I took only just a glimpse and was fading out again, but Tom says, "He ain't alive, you fools! It's the Sphinx!" I never see Tom look so little and like a fly, but that was because the giant's head was so big and awful. Awful, yes, so it was, but not dreadful any more, because you could see it was a noble face, and kind of sad, and not thinking about you, but about other things and larger. It was stone, reddish stone, and its nose and ears battered, and that gave it an abused look, and you felt sorry for it for that. We stood off a piece and sailed around it and over it, and it was just grand. It was a man's head, or maybe a woman's, on a tiger's body 125 foot long, and there was a dear little temple between its front paws. All but the head used to be under the sand for hundreds of years, maybe thousands, but they had just lately dug the sand away and found that little temple. It took a power of sand to bury that critter. Most of as much as it would to bury a steamboat, I reckon. We landed Jim on top of the head, with an American flag to protect him, it being a foreign land. Then we sailed off to this and that and t'other distance to get what Tom called effects and perspectives and proportions, and Jim he done the best he could, striking all the different kinds of attitudes and positions he could study up, but standing on his head and working his legs the way a frog does was the best. The further we got away, the littler Jim got, and the grander the Sphinx got, till at last it was only a clothespin on a dome, as you might say. That's the way perspective brings out the correct proportions, Tom said. He said Julius Caesar's niggers didn't know how big he was. They was too close to him. Then we sailed off further and further, till we couldn't see Jim at all any more, and then that great figure was at its noblest, gazing out over the Nile Valley, so still and solemn and lonesome, and all the little shabby huts and things that was scattered about it clean disappeared and gone, and nothing around it now but a soft, wide spread of yaller velvet, which was the sand. That was the right place to stop, and we done it. We set there a-looking and a-thinking for a half an hour, nobody a-saying anything, for it made us feel quiet and kind of solemn to remember it had been looking over that valley just that same way and thinking its awful thoughts all to itself for thousands of years, and nobody can't find out what they are to this day. At last I took up the glass and see some little black things a-capering around on that velvet carpet, and some more a-climbing up the critter's back, and then I see two or three wee puffs of white smoke, and told Tom to look. He done it and says, "They're bugs." "No. Hold on. They... why, I believe they're men. Yes, it's men. Men and horses both. They're hauling a long ladder up onto the Sphinx's back. Now, ain't that odd? And now they're trying to lean it up. There's some more puffs of smoke. It's guns. Huck, they're after Jim." We clapped on the power and went for them a-biling. We was there in no time, and come a-whizzing down amongst them, and they broke and scattered every which way, and some that was climbing the ladder after Jim let go all holts and fell. We soared up and found him laying on top of the head, panting and most tuckered out, partly from howling for help and partly from scare. He had been standing a siege a long time, a week, he said, but it weren't so. It only just seemed so to him because they was crowding him so. They had shot at him and rained the bullets all around him, but he weren't hit, and when they found he wouldn't stand up and the bullets couldn't get at him when he was laying down, they went for the ladder, and then he knowed it was all up with him if we didn't come pretty quick. Tom was very indignant and asked him why he didn't show the flag and command them to git in the name of the United States. Jim said he done it, but they never paid no attention. Tom said he would have this thing looked into at Washington, and says, "You'll see that they'll have to apologize for insulting the flag, and pay an indemnity, too, on top of it, even if they get off that easy. Jim says,
"What's an indemnity, Mars Tom?"
"It's cash, that's what it is."
"Who gets it, Mars Tom?"
"Why, we do."
"And who gets the apology?"
"The United States. Or we can take whichever we please. We can take the apology, if we want to, and let the government take the money."
"How much money will it be, Mars Tom?"
"Well, in an aggravated case like this one, it will be at least $3 apiece, and I don't know but more."
"Well, then, we'll take the money, Mars Tom, blame the apology. Ain't that your notion, too? And ain't it yourn, Huck?"
We talked it over a little and allowed that that was as good a way as any, so we agreed to take the money. It was a new business to me, and I asked Tom if countries always apologized when they had done wrong, and he says, "Yes, the little ones does." We was sailing around examining the pyramids, you know, and now we soared up and roosted on the flat top of the biggest one, and found it was just like what the man said in the Sunday school. It was like four pairs of stairs that starts broad at the bottom and slants up and comes together in a point at the top. Only these stair steps couldn't be clumb the way you climb other stairs. No, for each step was as high as your chin, and you have to be boosted up from behind. The two other pyramids weren't far away, and the people moving about on the sand between looked like bugs crawling, we was so high above them. Tom, he couldn't hold himself, he was so worked up with gladness and astonishment to be in such a celebrated place, and he just dripped history from every pore, seemed to me. He said he couldn't scarcely believe he was standing on the very identical spot the prince flew from on the bronze horse. It was in the Arabian Nights times, he said. Somebody give the prince a bronze horse with a peg in its shoulder, and he could get on him and fly through the air like a bird, and go all over the world, and steer it by turning the peg, and fly high or low, and land wherever he wanted to. When he got done telling it, there was one of them uncomfortable silences that comes, you know, when a person has been telling a whopper and you feel sorry for him and wish you could think of some way to change the subject and let him down easy, but get stuck and don't see no way, and before you can pull your mind together and do something, that silence has got in and spread itself and done the business. I was embarrassed. Jim, he was embarrassed, and neither of us couldn't say a word. Well, Tom, he glowered at me a minute and says, "Come, out with it. What do you think?" I says, "Tom Sawyer, you don't believe that yourself." "What's the reason I don't? What's to hinder me?" "There's one thing to hinder you. It couldn't happen, that's all." "What's the reason it couldn't happen?" "You tell me the reason it could happen." "This balloon is a good enough reason it could happen, I should reckon. Why is it?" "Why is it? I never saw such an idiot. Ain't this balloon and the bronze horse the same thing under different names?" "No, they're not. One is a balloon and the other's a horse. It's very different. Next you'll be saying a house and a cow is the same thing."
"By Jackson, Huck's got 'em again. They ain't no wiggling out of that."
"Shut your head, Jim. You don't know what you're talking about, and Huck don't. Look here, Huck, I'll make it plain to you, so you can understand. You see, it ain't the mere form that's got anything to do with their being similar or unsimilar. It's the principle involved, and the principle is the same in both. Don't you see now?" I turned it over in my mind and says, "Tom, it ain't no use. Principles is all very well, but they don't get around that one big fact that the thing that a balloon can do ain't no sort of proof of what a horse can do." "Shucks, Huck, you don't get the idea at all. Now, look here a minute. It's perfectly plain. Don't we fly through the air?" "Yes." "Very well. Don't we fly high or fly low, just as we please?" "Yes." "Don't we steer whichever way we want to?" "Yes." "And don't we land when and where we please?" "Yes." "How do we move the balloon and steer it?" "By touching the buttons." "Now I reckon the thing is clear to you at last. In the other case, the moving and steering was done by turning a peg. We touch a button, the prince turned a peg. There ain't an atom of difference, you see. I knowed I could get it through your head if I stuck to it long enough." He felt so happy he begun to whistle, but me and Jim was silent, so he broke off surprised and says, "Looky here, Huck Finn, don't you see it yet?" I says, "Tom Sawyer, I want to ask you some questions." "Go ahead," he says, and I see Jim chirk up to listen. As I understand it, the whole thing is in the buttons and the peg. The rest ain't of no consequence. A button is one shape, a peg is another shape, but that ain't any matter. No, that ain't any matter, as long as they both got the same power. All right, then. What is the power that's in a candle and in a match?
It's the fire.
It's the same in both, then?
Yes, just the same in both.
All right. Suppose I set fire to a carpenter shop with a match, what will happen to that carpenter shop?
She'll burn up.
And suppose I set fire to this pyramid with a candle, will she burn up?
Of course she won't.
All right. Now the fire's the same both times. Why does the shop burn and the pyramid don't?
Because the pyramid can't burn.
Aha! And a horse can't fly.
My land, if Huck ain't got him again. Huck's landed him high and dry this time, I tell you. It's the smartest trap I ever see a body walk into, and if I...
But Jim was so full of laugh, he got so strangled and couldn't go on, and Tom was that mad to see how neat I had floored him, and turned his own argument agin him, and knocked him all to rags and flinders with it, that all he could manage to say was that whenever he heard me and Jim try to argue, it made him ashamed of the human race. I never said nothing. I was feeling pretty well satisfied. When I have got the best of a person that way, it ain't my way to go around crowing about it the way some people does, for I consider that if I was in his place, I wouldn't wish him to crow over me. It's better to be generous. That's what I think.
End of chapter 12. This is chapter 13 of Tom Sawyer Abroad. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Tom Sawyer Abroad, Chapter 13, Going for Tom's Pipe.
By and by, we left Jim to float around up there in the neighborhood of the pyramids, and we clumbed down to the hole where you go into the tunnel, and went in with some Arabs and candles, and away in there in the middle of the pyramid, we found a room and a big stone box in it where they used to keep that king, just as the man in the Sunday school said. He was gone now. Somebody had got him. But I didn't take no interest in the place, because there could be ghosts there, of course. Not fresh ones, but I don't like no kind. So then we come out and got some little donkeys and rode a piece, and then went in a boat another piece, and then more donkeys, and got to Cairo. And all the way the road was as smooth and beautiful a road as ever I see, and had tall date palms on both sides, and naked children everywhere. And the man was as red as copper, and fine and strong and handsome. And the city was a curiosity. Such narrow streets! Why, they were just lanes, and crowded with people with turbans, and women with veils, and everybody rigged out in blazing bright clothes and all sorts of colors, and you wondered how the camels and the people got by each other in such narrow little cracks. But they done it. A perfect jam, you see, and everybody noisy. The stores weren't big enough to turn round in, but you didn't have to go in. The storekeeper sat tailor-fashion on his counter, smoking his sneaky long pipe, and had his things where he could reach them to sell, and he was just as good as in the street, for the camel-loads brushed him as they went by. Now and then a grand person flew by in a carriage with fancy-dressed men running and yelling in front of it, and whacking anybody with a long rod that didn't get out of the way. And by along comes the Sultan riding horseback at the head of a procession, and fairly took your breath away, his clothes was so splendid, and everybody fell flat and laid on his stomach while he went by. I forgot, but a feller helped me remember. He was one that had a rod and run in front. There was churches, but they don't know enough to keep Sunday. They keep Friday and break the Sabbath. You have to take off your shoes when you go in. There was crowds of men and boys in the church, setting in groups on the stone floor, and making no end of noise, getting their lessons by heart, Tom said, out of the Koran, which they think is a Bible, and people that knows better knows enough to not let on. I never see such a big church in my life before, and most awful high it was. It made you dizzy to look up. Our village church at home ain't a circumstance to it. If you was to put it in there, people would think it was a dry-goods box. What I wanted to see was a dervish, because I was interested in dervishes on accounts of the one that played the trick on the camel-driver. So we found a lot in a kind of church, and they called themselves whirling dervishes, and they did whirl, too. I never see anything like it. They had tall sugar-loaf hats on and linen petticoats, and they spun and spun and spun, round and round like tops, and the petticoats stood out on a slant, and it was the prettiest thing I ever see, and made me drunk to look at it. They was all Moslems, Tom said, and when I asked him what a Moslem was, he said it was a person that wasn't a Presbyterian. So there is plenty of them in Missouri, though I didn't know it before. We didn't see half there was to see in Cairo, because Tom was in such a sweat to hunt out places that was celebrated in history. We had a most tiresome time to find the granary where Joseph stored up the grain before the famine, and when we found it, it weren't worth much to look at, being such an old tumble-down wreck. But Tom was satisfied, and made more fuss over it than I would make if I stuck a nail in my foot. How he ever found that place was too many for me. We passed as much as 40 just like it before we come to it, and any of them would have done for me, but none but just the right one would suit him. I never see anybody so particular as Tom Sawyer. The minute he struck the right one, he recognized it, as easy as I would recognize my other shirt if I had one. But how he done it, he couldn't any more tell me than he could fly. He said so himself. Then we hunted a long time for the house where the boy lived that learned the caddy how to try the case of the old olives and the new ones, and said it was out of the Arabian Nights, and he would tell me and Jim about it when he got time. Well, we hunted and hunted till I was ready to drop, and I wanted Tom to give it up and come next day and get somebody that knowed the town and could talk Missourian and go straight to the place. But no, he wanted to find it himself, and nothing else would answer. So on we went. Then, at last, the remarkablest thing happened I ever see. The house was gone, gone hundreds of years ago, every last rag of it gone, but just one mud brick. Now, a person wouldn't ever believe that a backwoods Missouri boy that hadn't ever been in that town before could go and hunt that place over and find that brick, but Tom Sawyer done it. I know he done it, because I see him do it. I was right by his very side at the time, and see him see the brick and see him recognize it. Well, I says to myself, how does he do it? Is it knowledge, or is it instinct? Now, there's the facts, just as they happened. Let everybody explain it their own way. I've ciphered over it a good deal, and it's my opinion that some of it is knowledge, but the main bulk of it is instinct. The reason is this. Tom put the brick in his pocket to give to a museum with his name on it and the facts when he went home, and I slipped it out and put another brick considerable like it in its place, and he didn't know the difference. But there was a difference, you see. I think that settles it. It's mostly instinct, not knowledge. Instinct tells him where the exact place is for the brick to be in, and so he recognizes it by the place it's in, not by the look of the brick. If it was knowledge, not instinct, he would know the brick again by the look of it the next time he seen it, which he didn't. So it shows that, for all the brag you hear about knowledge being such a wonderful thing, instinct is worth 40 of it for real unerringness. Jim says the same. When we got back, Jim dropped down and took us in, and there was a young man there with a red skull cap and tassel on, and a beautiful silk jacket and baggy trousers, with a shawl around his waist and pistols in it, that could talk English and wanted to hire to us as guide and take us to Mecca and Medina and Central Africa and everywheres for a half a dollar a day and his keep, and we hired him and left and piled on the power. And by the time we was through dinner, we was over the place where the Israelites crossed the Red Sea when Pharaoh tried to overtake them and was caught by the waters. We stopped then and had a good look at the place, and it done Jim good to see it. He said he could see it all now, just the way it happened. He could see the Israelites walking along between the walls of water, and the Egyptians coming from away off yonder, hurrying all they could, and see them start in as the Israelites went out, and then, when they was all in, see the walls tumble together and drown the last man of them. Then we piled on the power again and rushed away and hovered over Mount Sinai and saw the place where Moses broke the tables of stone and where the children of Israel camped in the plain and worshipped the golden calf and it was all just as interesting as could be, and the guide knowed every place as well as I knowed the village at home. But we had an accident now, and it fetched all the plans to a standstill. Tom's old ornery corncob pipe had got so old and swelled and warped that she couldn't hold together any longer, notwithstanding the strings and bandages, but caved in and went to pieces. Tom, he didn't know what to do. The professor's pipe wouldn't answer. It weren't anything but a meerschaum, and a person that's got used to a cob pipe knows it lays a long ways over all the other pipes in this world, and you can't get him to smoke any other. He wouldn't take mine. I couldn't persuade him. So there he was. He thought it over, and said we must scour around and see if we could roust out one in Egypt or Arabia or around in some of these countries, but the guide said no, it weren't no use. They didn't have them. So Tom was pretty glum for a little while. Then he chirked up and said he'd got the idea and knowed what to do. He says, I've got another corncob pipe, and it's a prime one, too, and nearly new. It's laying on the rafter that's right over the kitchen stove at home in the village. Jim, you and the guide will go and get it, and me and Huck will camp here on Mount Sinai till you come back.
But, Mars Tom, we couldn't ever find a village. I could find a pipe, 'cause I knows the kitchen. But, my land, we can't ever find a village, nur St. Louis, nur none of them places. We don't know the way, Mars Tom.
That was a fact, and it stumped Tom for a minute. Then he said, Looky here, it can be done, sure, and I'll tell you how. You set your compass and sail west as straight as a dart till you find the United States. It ain't any trouble, because it's the first land you'll strike the other side of the Atlantic. If it's daytime when you strike it, bulge right on, straight west from the upper part of the Florida coast, and in an hour and three quarters you'll hit the mouth of the Mississippi at the speed that I'm going to send you. You'll be so high up in the air that the earth will be curved considerable, sort of like a washbowl turned upside down, and you'll see a raft of rivers crawling around every which way long before you get there, and you can pick out the Mississippi without any trouble. Then you can follow the river north nearly an hour and three quarters till you see the Ohio come in. Then you want to look sharp, because you're getting near. Away up to your left you'll see another thread coming in. That's the Missouri, and is a little above St. Louis. You'll come down low then, so as you can examine the villages as you spin along. You'll pass about 25 in the next 15 minutes, and you'll recognize ours when you see it, and if you don't, you can yell down and ask.
If it's that easy, Mars Tom, I reckon we can do it. Yes, I knows we can.
The guide was sure of it, too, and thought that he could learn to stand his watch in a little while. Jim can learn you the whole thing in a half an hour, Tom said. This balloon's as easy to manage as a canoe. Tom got out the chart and marked out the course and measured it, and says, To go back west is the shortest way, you see. It's only about 7,000 miles. If you went east, and so on around, it's over twice as far. Then he says to the guide, I want you both to watch the telltale all through the watches, and whenever it don't mark 300 miles an hour, you go higher or drop lower till you find a storm current that's going your way. There's 100 miles an hour in this old thing, without any wind to help. There's 200-mile gales to be found any time you want to hunt for them.
We'll hunt for them, sir.
See that you do. Sometimes you may have to go up a couple of miles, and it'll be pison cold, but most of the time you'll find your storm a good deal lower. If you can only strike a cyclone, that's the ticket for you. You'll see by the professor's books that they travel west in these latitudes, and they travel low, too. Then he ciphered on the time and says, 7,000 miles, 300 miles an hour. You can make the trip in a day, 24 hours. This is Thursday. You'll be back here Saturday afternoon. Come now, hustle out some blankets and food and books and things for me and Huck, and you can start right along. There ain't no occasion to fool around. I want a smoke, and the quicker you fetch that pipe, the better. All hands jumped for the things, and in 8 minutes our things was out and the balloon was ready for America. So we shook hands goodbye, and Tom gave his last orders. It's 2:10 p.m. now, Mount Sinai time. In 24 hours you'll be home, and it'll be 6 tomorrow morning, village time, when you strike the village. Land a little back of the top of the hill in the woods, out of sight.
Then you rush down, Jim, and shove these letters in the post office, and if you see anybody stirring, pull your slouch down over your face so they don't know you. Then you go and slip in the back way to the kitchen and get the pipe, and lay this piece of paper on the kitchen table, and put something on it to hold it, and then slide out and get away, and don't let Aunt Polly catch a sight of you nor anybody else. Then you jump for the balloon and shove for Mount Sinai 300 miles an hour. You won't have lost more than an hour. You'll start back at 7 or 8 a.m. village time, and be here in 24 hours, arriving at 2 or 3 p.m. Mount Sinai time. Tom, he read the piece of paper to us. He had wrote on it, Thursday afternoon. Tom Sawyer, the aeronaut, sends his love to Aunt Polly from Mount Sinai, where the Ark was, and so does Huck Finn, and she will get it tomorrow morning 6:30. Tom Sawyer, the aeronaut. Note, this misplacing of the Ark is probably Huck's error, not Tom's. M.T.
That'll make her eyes bulge out and the tears come, he says. Then he says, Stand by. 1, 2, 3. Away you go. And away she did go. Why, she seemed to whiz out of sight in a second. Then we found a most comfortable cave that looked out over the whole big plain, and there we camped to wait for the pipe. The balloon come back all right and brung the pipe, but Aunt Polly had catched Jim when he was getting it, and anybody can guess what happened. She sent for Tom. So Jim, he says,
"Mars Tom, she's out on the porch, with her eyes sot on the sky lying for you, and she say she ain't going to budge from there till she gets a hold of you. Dey's gwine to be trouble, Mars Tom, deed dey is."
So then we shoved for home, and not feeling very gay neither.
The end of Tom Sawyer Abroad by Mark Twain.
Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.